And now, on with the show.
Hello, 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 and welcome to a brand new episode of Film Fracas. What is up, everybody? How's everybody doing? I, of course, am Robbie DeShazer. With me, as always, are Carter, the whole effing show, Spilliards.
Hello, hello, hello.
Brett, The Rock Johnson.
Happy to be here.
And Shannon, I totally forgot what we gave.
The Live Wire.
The Live Wire Widener.
Thank you.
Here for her first full official episode as a host.
Woot, woot.
We're very excited. Third time you've been on the podcast, and now it's real.
It's real. It's official. Real. Thank you, guys.
We put a ring on it. Not really. We don't have money for rings. That would require
not
funding.
Yet.
It's what it is it's like a whole bunch of rings. Like it's like four rings, but then it's got the word like film and then fracas on the other, and you wear them like brass knuckles on either hand.
Okay. Okay.
You put your fist together and it just says film fracas.
Once again, we still don't have the funding for it.
Oh, I definitely ordered a set for all of us.
I am so excited.
They're made of plastic, I hope you know.
That's fine. Because I was going to say if we had rings, it would just be like the plastic ring from like a Dr. Pepper bottle.
But I know where to find some gold bouillon, so we can just coat them in that.
Oh, boy.
Sounds like a good time.
This is now film get-rich-quick schemes with Carter Spilliards.
So it's not a pyramid scheme.
It's not a pyramid scheme. It's a ring scheme. but of course, we're not here to chat about, you know, getting rich quick off of ring schemes. We're here to do some talking about a whole brand new set of films on this season premiere of season four of Film Fracas.
Yeah.
Wow.
Damn time.
Finally.
I was going to say, it only took us a week. I mean, what were we doing?
I know. This
is absurd.
What a short break between seasons.
I know. Anywho.
This is the season we've all been looking forward to. Season three was short, and it was good. I enjoyed our conversation. Yeah. We did a lot of cool experimental stuff, but this is the season I've been looking forward to for a while now.
Let's stop talking about it and do it.
Names.
Let's give our eight films once again.
So our eight films this season,
Their names are...
They all have titles.
The Dark Knight, The Fugitive, The Lion King, The Prestige... Two Nolans, Before Sunrise, Pulp Fiction, our second Tarantino, Back to the Future, and Singing in the Rain, our third musical.
Our third live-action musical.
Live-action musical.
Yes. We had a whole bunch of Disney musicals.
Apparently that's a facet of our podcast.
We always get to a score episode, and I think always one of us is like, well, eventually a musical will get to the score
episode. You would think.
And wreck shop.
We finally got a really good musical this time, too.
I'm so excited to talk about all these. But, of course, we're not just talking about these in general. We aren't going to get to that. We got to nitpick the hell out of all these movies. We got to start with today's topic, which is production design. I think the best way to kind of introduce yourself to a film is to really just look at it as a whole and get, you know, just a feel for what that movie looks like. And you can learn a lot about it from that.
Now, our production design is pretty inclusive.
Yes.
Of set design, costume design, art direction.
Color palette.
Just everything that encompasses how the film looks is what we would describe as production design.
Everything short of, lighting.
Everything short of lighting. Because
we
pretty much
include that in, like, a cinematography.
Yes, cinematography.
Yeah.
Yes, and performance. This is just how the film looks when you're looking at it.
Yes.
This is the one where the word meticulously comes up a lot, and Brett groans the whole episode.
I don't know if any of these are meticulous.
That's every episode that I've
Well, I could grown. Describe one of these as meticulous.
There's a couple of things. I think there's more meticulous in these films than we think.
How about instead of talking about in generalities, we just get into it?
Sure. What's the first film we want to talk about?
The Fugitive.
The Fugitive.
The Fugitive. Hey-o.
We all just finished watching The Fugitive and immediately started recording.
Yeah.
Carter and I had a four-film marathon today. Catching up on all of these before we started recording.
They're all pretty fresh.
Yes. So.
Whereas I've taken the opposite approach. I haven't seen any of these. And I'm going to work backwards.
Oh.
Oh.
No, that's not true. I was trying to do a bit, but I'm not funny.
Oh. It's okay. You'll
Good
get
effort.
There one day. Yes, The Fugitive.
The Fugitive.
Which has a look to it.
Yes.
That look is late 80s, early 90s Chicago.
Yes. It does it very well.
Because it is filmed in location in early 90s Chicago.
Early 90s Chicago. But damn it, if I don't love all the trench coats and the scarves. My God, that film has a look. People running through the woods.
That bus.
The bus.
He gets hit by a train.
Everything looks exactly as I would hope it to look in that movie.
Yes.
Like, nothing seems out of place. Everything seems very authentic because it is.
Except for the one scene of Harrison Ford turning into a mannequin and jumping off of the dam.
When they throw him off the dam and it's very clearly a mannequin and he just splays out on the way down.
I feel like that's not very authentic.
No.
But I can't fault them too much. You can't throw a stuntman off a dam. I mean,
I do quite enjoy
nothing to lose.
Tom Cruise would have done that.
I do quite.
Almost definitely. But this was before even Tom Cruise would do that.
So?
This is when Tom Cruise still had something to lose.
Does not change the fact that Tom Cruise would do that.
Today, yeah.
True.
Yeah.
I do quite enjoy the look of this movie. It's got a nice, like... It's not a pretty movie. It's got a nice, like, grime to it, because, like, Harrison
Ford... Chicago had a nice grime to it. That's true.
And, I mean, it's like Harrison Ford's on the run, and he's, like, getting down dirty, like, hiding in places, and, like...
Spreading mud on his face on accident. Yeah. Just because he had mud on his hands, and then
Tommy Lee Jones and his excellently silly hats... It's great.
I did love Tommy Lee Jones' black trench coat with the red scarf, and it's just like...
Furiously running downstairs, like, everything flapping behind him.
And he just looks so out of place with everything else, because everybody's got, like, the brown and, like, gray trench coats, and here he is just the, like, black with a scarlet red, and it's like, who, what?
Tommy Lee Jones,
Mr. U.S. Marshall.
Tommy Lee Jones, who specifically uses a Velcro patch to cover up his badge, that he then rips off to reveal he's a U.S. Marshal.
He's like, no, this is my investigation. And it's like, oh. You could have spared everybody a lot of confusion if you just had that visible rather than think you're just some random guy intruding on the crime scene.
Watching this again, it is abundantly clear why we got a U.S. Marshal sequel.
Oh, yes.
Because Tommy Lee Jones is the second coolest thing about that movie. The first, of course, being Harrison Ford.
Yes.
But not. This isn't about their performances.
No.
It's about how cool they look.
How cool they look. Correct.
I think I love especially how, and maybe this is just a quality of all action films, but there's this wonderful, like, breakability of everything in all of the scenes. Wood, glass, picture frames, bones,
that's so true.
Hearts, whatever you want it to be. Everything snaps with a very nice, resounding crunch, and there's pretty much something broken in almost every scene. So I thought that was particularly nice, and I feel like that's not something you always see.
Does Harrison Ford ever break, or does he just get punctured a lot?
There's a lot of good punch sound bites.
Yeah, well, to bounce off of Shannon, when that end fight, when Dr. Nichols just takes that chair and it just shatters over Harrison Ford, it's like, wow, that's a weak chair.
Exactly, but it looks so satisfying.
But, like, it does, but just like that whole fight sequence, it's just like all like this body blow sounds. I'm like, oh, that's how you know a movie's from the 90s or the 80s, is when just every punch sounds like someone's just like hitting a honey ham or something with like a...
That's very specific.
Because that's how you make
that's true.
At least like
a sock full of nickels, just
like a sock with like billiard balls hitting a piece of meat. And I'm like, yep, that's how you know a movie is from that time period.
That and the saxophone in the score.
The very overstated score.
Yes.
We'll get to that in a score episode if this makes it that far.
Much later. But yeah, it's just... Yeah, like, it looks good. That grime is there. And at first I was kind of like, oh, so this movie's just, like, it's just from the 90s. But then, like, as it kept going, I was like, okay, no, I feel like this was a choice rather than, like, oh, mm-hmm. This is the film that we have. And so, like, the grime was nice. But I'm not, would that fit more into, would that be production design or more cinematography?
It'd be production design, because it's how it looks. Because what I
was just asking for my own
clarification. Yeah, because you see, like, Harrison Ford start when he's, like, the fugitive escaping everything. Yeah. He's, like, running through the mud, getting covered in mud, goes to all these dingy places. He's, like, wearing the janitor uniform and all this. But then by the end of the film, he's in, like, the nice blazer and jeans, mm-hmm. Like, okay. Looking all nice and clean, going into the hotel, which is all, like, spotless until they start, like, beating each other up. So yeah. You kind of see this transition of as he's getting, like, closer and closer to the truth.
No, yeah. Like,
like the film's brightening up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you see him start in a place.
I saw the same movie.
I know.
He starts in a place that is also a lot cleaner. He's got this well-groomed beard. He's got his hair is
perfectly spotless, incredibly white home. And, I mean, you know, I like the fact, too, that we get the beginning with his wife being, well, I don't like that his wife is murdered, I suppose.
No one likes
sorry,
no one
likes of course. But I mean,
I don't care.
Exactly. It's like, don't even care. It's a white walled home, white furniture, white carpet. We get to the very end of the film as well. There's a resounding amount of whiteness. And I think I also noticed this right as he's like getting the crap beat out of him. So I'm like, oh, okay, maybe he's, you know, this is mirroring how his wife died. He's nearly about to die. But, you know, the whiteness, the color palette, I think is very important for this film because it's either disgusting or very cleanly white or some amount of gold opulence, I guess, and with a few primary colors in there, especially in the hotel. You have the violet fold or whatever where everybody's speaking. But I think that's particularly important, I think. That's what I definitely looked at. And The Fugitive.
The one scene where the production really jumped out at me is because it was so different from everything else. Because like you watch this movie, it's like, yes, this is Chicago. Okay, we're in Chicago. But then when he infiltrates the hospital and he's like going through the whole wing with the prosthetics, and you just see like the labs and the people working and all the various limbs and everything. I was kind of like, oh my, this is intricate. This is different. This is weird. I like this a lot because I was not expecting a sequence of going through all the various stages of prosthetic limbs and everything, but like I very much liked it. It felt weird, felt out of place, but then again, a guy with a prosthetic arm would be out of place.
It's a part of and a hospital you don't normally see.
Yeah, and that's, but like, so I'm saying it's out of place, but that's not a knock. I'm saying that's just how it feels, but it's good and it works. And so that's the part that really stuck out to me about everything.
For sure. Yeah. No, this movie definitely has a look to it. I think it does a good job of being consistent in that look, or when it does change it, being noticeable, but also like working for the plot, like we were talking about. Like as the truth becomes more clear, things become less grimy.
Yeah. True.
You know, when you run into a young Jane Lynch... Everything starts to clear up.
That's true.
That's a life lesson for y'all.
Jane Lynch and Julianne Moore for 5 minutes.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Does anyone have any knocks against this?
I have a couple, but I'll get to those once we start talking about some other movies.
Okay, yeah, sure. All right. For sure. Let's move on.
Let's move on to something completely different. The Lion King?
Hey, sure, yeah.
It's got another specific look.
It does. Specifically...
Lions.
And rocks.
Hakunas.
Matatas.
There's also a lot of texture in this movie. That's particularly important, but also a lot of hakunas and matatas.
What a wonderful phrase.
Oh, no.
Anyway.
It means no worries.
All the rest of your days.
No, you can't put the tune with it. We have to pay money.
Ooh.
Why would you do that?
We did a whole season about Disney. I do not think Disney cares about us.
No, they really don't.
Bob Iger, come on the podcast.
Please?
Please? But no, Lion King's got
good.
A lot of good looks. Yeah, just good.
Good.
That's all you need. There it is. Moving on.
No, it's in terms of an animated movie, it's got some very rich colors.
Oh yeah,
with the oranges and the grays and the. I'm always been partial to the when the whole be prepared and like the greens when they pop in there because I'm like, ooh, look at this.
A great example of that Disney villain green being used.
Disney villain green. I love it.
But then it just like turns into like that blood red. Mm-hmm. It's like oh
yes,
oh my.
Well, and I love the design of everything.
Oh, yeah, the design of everything's fantastic.
It's like very, I don't know, Disney always does a good job of striking the like realistic with the unrealistic. Mm-hmm.
And it's like they don't look too cartoony. They're cartoons, though. But, I mean, they definitely, like, strike that balance of not looking too real but not too fake kind of thing.
Like, if an animal was anthropomorphic, this is probably what that would look like.
Absolutely. What I think about is the I Just Can't Wait to Be King scene where you've got the even faker looking but, like, that traditional drawing style to the animals in some scenes and stuff.
It gives it a very theatrical quality.
Yes, it does, which is why I think, in a side note, you know, props to Disney for the production design on this. It transfers so well to a Broadway stage because it can look like that. Mm-hmm. Because it can look both traditional in the cultures that it's taking from, but also look incredibly well designed and distinct as an animated movie from that time period. Mm-hmm. It excels in all of those categories, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely think this film perhaps exceeds best in its rich use of color.
Yes,
I don't know anything
sure.
else uses such a broad spectrum of colors, but whether it be like out with like Timon and Pumbaa and so many like tropical greens and whatnot, or back on Pride Rock with the oranges and reds, and then it goes to like gray when it's been taken over. And what always sticks out to me is when you see Mufasa in the sky. And just, like, the composition of that shot of him in the sky and all the stars and clouds. Yeah. It's just so gorgeous every time.
Yes.
And it's like that took a lot of meticulous planning.
So since this is an animated film, I have a question. Can we talk about character design in this? Or is that...
We touched on it a little bit.
I was wondering how much we wanted to get into that.
But yeah, the designs are part of the production.
Things are still realistic, like, you know... Zazu is not, you know, a giant bird, but like,
that's true.
But his size does, you know, indicate his stature compared to maybe other birds you see in the world, as well as, you know, there's just stuff there where it's like you can communicate realness while also still telling a story with, you know, your basic character shapes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Rafiki is a wise baboon who is quite large if you thought about the size of an actual baboon compared to, you know.
Yeah.
He's walking on two legs taller than Simba at times, and you're like, cool. Not the real size. But, like, it communicates the story so well, and it doesn't feel out of place or too cartoony. It's just once you start nitpicking that you really get to, like, you know, you start thinking about it too much. But I think the beauty there is that it does convey the story, and it, you know, does a service.
Yeah.
I think the last thing I'm going to say as far as The Lion King goes, just because, you know, we can only talk about beautiful, lush color palettes for such an extended length of time, I guess is kind of piggybacking a little bit on what Carter was saying about the fact that it's a movie that doesn't, I mean, it looks just cartoony enough, but there's some sophistication in the design. I mean, there's a lot of great use of light, shadow, and depth in the design of a lot of... I mean, I'm thinking of the stampede scene, all of the texture of the rock. I mean, if you're looking at all of the amount of little dots and blips and perfect organic little crevices that pop up in square inches of surface, I mean, somebody sat down and was paid to do this and, you know, I don't know what they were listening, what they're using to listening to their music on, like, you know, Walkmans, was that 90s-ish? You know, someone was popping down all kinds of dots and stuff on there. So, I mean, there's meticulous detail. it's great. It takes a lot of time to do that. And, of course, you know, that's not what The Lion King really is known for. But, you know, I really did have to appreciate that. It's great to look at.
It's true. The one part of the designs that I've always found super impressive was how they managed to design grown-up Simba, and how, like, they could have just as easily just taken, like, the Mufasa design and just reused that animation and just been like, oh, yeah, this is old Simba. See how he looks like Mufasa? But, like, they made him look similar but also, like, just different, like, different enough to where you could, like, see the difference between the two of them. And I always thought that was really impressive because it would have been very easy to just be like, oh, no, this isn't the same lion. This is Simba now. He just looks and moves exactly like his father.
Yeah.
And so I've always really appreciated that.
Well, with what Shannon was just talking about too, during our Disney season, we talked a lot about the blending of of computer 3D animation and 2D cell animation that was used for a lot of these early 90s Disney movies. I think this is the one that perfected it, honestly.
Oh, yes.
Like, which is why I'm kind of glad it made it to this season instead of being with those other Disney ones, because then when we're like, well, you know, the Cave of Wonders looks like shit, but like everything in The Lion King is beautiful. Like, it's just no contest.
I don't think there's a single moment in The Lion King where I was like, that doesn't look quite right, or that hasn't aged well.
Right. Yeah. There was not, which I was so impressed with, especially with watching it on Blu-ray, where sometimes like those animated movies start to look a little faded or something when they get that.
Gets a little too refined.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Stuff like that where you start losing lines. And
yeah.
But Lion King, I felt like none of that was there for me, at least.
It was good.
So,
it's good.
Anyone have anything negative to say about The Lion King?
Too orange.
Shit film.
Too orange. How dare they?
Not off the top of my head, but if I think something later, I'll be sure to bring it up.
Okay.
It's a fave.
I guess the only thing I'm... And this is just a personal... No, I mean, it's The Lion King. It's a perfect Disney movie. I guess except for the fact that... No, Simba's always a little too yellow for me.
He is very
a little
yellow.
Too richly golden yellow, which I think that I'd just comes down to a preference point.
Brown.
Golden brown. See, I see more yellow. He's always yellow. That's fine. That's
he
okay.
He is very yellow.
But all of the lionesses, the same shade.
That's true. Nala never, like... She's like all of the
There's
lionesses
no color
are kind
development.
Of a dim, yeah, they're kind of like a dim golden.
Like a dingy,
yeah.
Light honey-colored dishwater. Like it.
That
might be the only
dishwater.
Thing.
That's true. You bring up a good point.
That's going to be my second band name, honey-colored
dishwater.
Honey-colored dishwater.
Okay, you
heard
it here.
What's your first band name?
Suspicious Bulge.
Oh.
Also, why is Scar the only one who's a different color?
Because he's evil.
Yes, but also...
Because he's evil.
I mean...
Archetypes.
True.
Archetypes.
Because he's evil.
Fine.
He also has a scar because he's evil.
Well, we know that.
He pushes Mufasa off a cliff because he's evil.
Fine.
I think eye color is something... Well, not like the color of the iris, but like...
Well, I'd have to think about that.
Yeah, like I think I was looking at the eyes of the characters a little bit, and you go from having like a white of the eye to like a yellowish hue to different whites of the eyes.
Oh, for sure.
And like, I mean, I think when Simba's younger, his eye color or his iris is redder than it progresses to be. So y'all look again at this.
Do
I don't know if
that's just like an animation disparity.
It very well could be. It's like not a, like an issue.
A
issue.
I don't know.
You never know. Where's
age? Blind.
Like, I know what you're
cataract
talking.
Issues.
Like, yeah. Do you think it could just be like
blind
the youth
as a cat.
Just to delineate like youth from
that's what I always thought.
That makes the most
I know
sense.
I know exactly what you're talking about, but I don't think it was a mistake.
No.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Well,
there are no mistakes in
the
Lion King.
Yes. Let's go from something very vibrant.
Blind as a cat.
To the opposite. The Dark Knight.
Blind as a bat.
Who loves
just
darkness. So much darkness. So much darkness.
Another film shot in Chicago.
True. Yes, The Dark Knight was in Chicago.
We started looking all these up. The Dark Knight trilogy has... So Batman Begins and The Dark Knight, both of them are Chicago Gothams. And then The Dark Knight Rises is New York, Pittsburgh, and Los Angeles.
Yeah, and that's why it looks so much different from the other two.
It always bothers
and
me.
And it's very distracting.
It always bothers me that Wayne Enterprises is a different building in every movie.
Oh, yeah.
Every single movie, it's a different building. And I'm like, how do they get away with this?
Because you can.
It's I mean, also, Rachel's a different person in every movie.
Well, Rachel's only a different person in two movies.
It counts. Exactly. It's important enough.
Sorry, I'll bleep out that big spoiler there.
Spoiler alert. Anywho. This movie is beautiful.
Yes.
It even
in its own way. Yeah.
In a very distinct way.
It opens with the dark, like black and then dark blue logos of everything. So it's going into it. You're like, oh, this is dark. And then the whole movie is physically dark.
Except for the scenes that are in broad daylight.
Except for the broad daylight when it's extremely bright.
Except in broad daylight and in the, like, the temporary bat cave under the shipping yard.
Where it's also a very like clean fluorescent light.
I love that.
That set
is probably one of my favorite things in any movie ever. Just like you just see it stretching to like infinity both ways, just stark white, but somehow all this stuff is
popping out of the floors, out of the walls.
They have like built-in furnaces that they're just burning the documents. And then like he sets up like the whole gun test and everything. I'm like, where did this come from? How did you get this set up? Was that just you and Alfred lugging this stuff around from topside, or did you just have that in one of your pop-up closets?
Yes.
But that's one of my favorite sets of like anything ever. It's so good.
Yes, we can gush on and on and on about all kinds of things. But what I'm going to say, my favorite part, my favorite aspect of this film has to be the costume design. Whether it be Batman, who gets a new suit, he can finally turn his head, which is lovely. He doesn't have to worry about dogs, even though they keep trying to attack him.
But it makes him more susceptible to gunfire. Makes and him knives,
I, not which that, is unfortunate.
Not that the Batman Begins movie is relevant to this conversation. Were dogs an issue in Batman Begins?
No, it's because Dark Knight opens with.
Okay, just I wanted to make sure this. Doberman. Yeah, wanted to make sure this was a new problem for Batman.
Yeah,
but for me, where it's at is Harvey Dent, Two-Face, and the Joker. The Joker's costume in this movie, I mean, they were fighting the biggest uphill battle anyone's ever done, and they nailed it with something completely different than I think anyone was expecting. And it was
very good.
It captures what the Joker is at a very visceral level.
Yeah.
It's like...
It's very different from the Joker's past, whether it was the 60s television show or the animated series or even Jack Nicholson's.
And what I really like about it is that they went just dark, just edgy, just realist enough without like going over that edgy edge without, so it like didn't become like
far edgy edge. Okay, sorry.
So it didn't become like farcical.
Don't
like,
cut yourself on that edge, boys.
I'm talking. So it didn't become like farcical like Jared Leto's did, where it's kind of like, ooh, look how edgy this guy is. Where it is like, oh, don't cut yourself on that edge there, Jared, or whatever. It's like. It's just dark enough and just like visceral and real enough without going too far to where it becomes laughable. Whereas like Jack Nicholson's was more laughable, but that's because it was a completely different take on the character.
It was very cartoony.
Harvey Dent and his costuming and the whole design of his two
faces. Yeah, the whole design of his two faces.
Yeah, Batman and the Joker, the three of them, their costume designs, all like the gadgets and the bat pod and everything. That's what I think, because I was. When we were talking about The Fugitive, I was comparing it directly to The Dark Knight, where it's like they're both shot in Chicago. And while like I do like the look of The Fugitive, when you get down to it, it is just kind of like, this is Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Whereas with The Dark Knight, it's like, this is Chicago. But look at all this other extra stuff.
Gotham.
This is Chicago.
It's Gotham. It's got to be a different city.
But you know what I'm saying, though. Yeah. It's like, oh, yep, this is a city. And there's only so much you can do to be like, oh, look at this city. When it's the same cities, but there's so much other extra stuff going on in The Dark Knight.
Well, the thing with The Dark Knight, though, is it's supposed to be heavily stylized.
No, like, yeah, and I
get it is heavily stylized. Yeah. But there's points, like, when you're watching the Lamborghinis, like, when he's doing the chase with the Lamborghini.
The Lamborghini there's, scene.
I mean, once you know that's in Chicago, you know you're looking down from L stations at the car.
And, like, and then during Commissioner Loeb's funeral, where it's like, yep, this is, it's just shots of the city and the buildings and stuff. But, like
going into the banks, which are like stuff like that's like the Chicago Tribune buildings, one of the banks. Like, there's some stuff in there that's definitely just, you know,
but
they're replacing a sign.
But there is so much other stuff there, and like,
No, but the thing
and
about
so that's what really saves it for me.
The thing about the Joker's costume that I love so much is like, they even say it, he's like, oh, he wears a cheap purple suit. And it's like, you look at his suit. If you look at his suit, he wears, like, a nice shirt. It's, like, nice. Like, the overcoat, I don't know. We don't get a lot of good, shots of it. But the vest and the actual shirt he's wearing are, like, nice clothes. And then he's got the makeup to cover his scars. But the thing that always gets me is his hair. Because his hair is so gross all the time.
Stringy,
and it's
greasy.
Like, it's Heath Ledger's blonde hair, but it's green, but it's not, like... It's not like neon green. It's like a really gross, like
grimy,
grimy. Like, but the thing is, like, only in certain lights when it hits it, it's like green. But even if he's just walking around, you're like, oh, it's just really, really gross looking. And it's like, especially at the end when he's hanging upside down and they've got like the light shining on his face, you can see everything's really highlighted. That's when I'm always like, he looks the most like the Joker there, because like you can see the purple in his suit and you know the green in his hair, and all the makeup is when he's like hanging in the bright lights at the very end,
which is why that's like, an iconic
yeah,
shot.
Yeah, so I'm like, that's the Joker kind of thing. And then with Harvey Dent, because you have his whole like the White Knight of Gotham, and so he always wears like bright gray suits and stuff. And then finally when he becomes Two-Face and it's all scarred and like charred and black, and he's got the scarred disgusting face, which they could have done so many different ways, but the way they did it is so like in your face, and it's like, yes, look at this. This is what would actually happen. It's disgusting.
But is it what would actually
happen? No, he'd be dead.
He would be 100%
yes,
dead.
Yes, definitely that.
He would be 100% dead.
There's no way he only gets half of his body
back. But it's as close to...
Yeah, I'm just,
if someone were to get having some fun. Only half their body burned and survive that.
Well, and even the Scarecrow's at the beginning, too.
Yeah.
And I love the design of the Scarecrow. We can talk a little bit. That's more Batman Begins.
But, I mean, he's in this movie.
He's in this movie. And so Scarecrow also has some excellent character design.
And then also the Bat Imposters.
Yeah.
Just these guys, like, trying their damnedest.
They're wearing
like,
hockey pads.
Like, yeah, like, their hockey pads. It's kind of like, it's like, this is what people who are trying to be Batman would do, and this is what they would look like. And, I totally forgot about that until it's just now. But it's like, it just makes me sad.
It's very early Spider-Man, if that makes sense. Like, someone who doesn't have the... funds or the abilities to like be a Batman,
but they
doing their best job,
but have the means to acquire automatic weapons, and it's like, and I just love how it's so like antithetical of like what Batman like is trying to do and like how he goes about his mission and everything. And it's just like, oh, no, you guys are dumb. Like your hearts are in the right places, but you're so dumb.
I also love that like in order to be everywhere like Batman is, there has to be like three or four of them. Which is just fun. Because you get those, you know, so similar shots to like when Batman's like jumping down from the rafters and appearing behind people. And so and it's like, oh no, this is four distinct different Batmans.
Yeah. Well, and I also love
Batman.
I love the police station too. Because like out in the station, it's like gross. But then in the cell, the interrogation room, when it's the Joker and it's like bright. And it's just that light
and it's like
shining, illuminating.
And it's like an abnormally large interrogation room. Because you only ever see it when there's like one person in there. And it's like, why is this room so big?
And there's also a table. So the table's at the back. And then there's all this middle space where they're throwing the Joker around.
And it's just like, why did you make this so big? How many people are you going to interrogate in here at the same time?
Just for the VIPs.
So Batman can throw around criminals. What I will touch on is... why I think Chicago was a good choice for filming for this one, which I think it definitely is a big part of production design. Because during the day, during The Dark Knight, like everything looks very clean and pristine and opulent, and you see the grandness of the city, and then at night, that's when it gets grimy. That's when you get your fugitive looks, your deep seedy underworld. That's how the city of Chicago is. During the day, no one's gonna like mug you or anything. Like, people just walk about doing their,
their lives,
their business. You know, there's like eight different schools that are all in session downtown at any time. Like, and then at night, that's when you stick to only a couple of the subway lines because those are the ones that are gonna have cops on them. Like, that's the way it works there. And so I think that they're while it may not be obvious for a lot of people that haven't, lived or, know a lot about Chicago, have family there, whatever. I think it's a great choice because of that. For people that grew up there or stuff, there's, like, definitely big similarities between Gotham and...
Well, Gotham is, like, widely considered to be based on Chicago, isn't it? Because it's, Metropolis is New York.
No, it's supposed to be Metropolis is New York during the daytime.
Mm-hmm.
Gotham is supposed to be New York during the nighttime, because in a lot of the other iterations of Gotham, it is always just dark and just dirty and just crime ridden. Like the Dark Knight, ironically, is like one of the brighter, like maybe one of the brightest interpretations of Gotham's that like I've seen.
Yeah,
reading all my comics, watching all my cartoons and everything, but that's at least. Based on how I remember them talking about how they came up with Gotham, it was supposed to be like, there's supposed to be two sides of that coin, but Gotham is supposed to be more New York than it is Chicago, but I think they made the right choice filming it in Chicago.
Because I've always heard, like, Metropolis is New York, Gotham is Chicago. There's, like, what is it? The Coastal City?
Coast City.
Yeah, Coast City is L.A. And, like, Star City is Detroit. Kind of thing. I've always heard that that's how they kind of correlate.
And New Detroit is Dallas.
I mean, like, you can make that. Like, that's fair. But I've always heard it. That's like Gotham is New York at night. Metropolis is New York during the day.
That also makes sense.
But yeah,
Chicago is kind of New York at night.
Yeah.
But yeah, like thinking about it, like I am glad they filmed in Chicago, just because like if it was filmed in New York, it would just be so obvious that it's like, oh hey, here we are in New York. You know where all the big movies are filmed.
Yeah, especially those daytime scenes when you're like. Oh, that's clearly Fifth Avenue. Or, you know,
something like that.
Watch Batman run through Times Square.
Chicago also definitely has a look that is different. Like, similar to New York, but different.
Different enough,
you can tell when a movie is in, like, Chicago versus New York.
It's a very... So, it's still towering, but it's a lot more blocky. It's not as curved as...
Well, and I love that, like I said, they make a conscious effort, because Gotham is a fictional city, to make it its own thing. So, like, yes, there are certain things that you're like, oh, that is Chicago. But also, they try really hard to make you like, this is its own city that exists here.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't, when the ferry scene happens, you don't see Navy Pier.
Yeah.
Like, just to, like, give you the...
Yeah.
The easiest way, like, you don't see Navy Pier, you don't see, I can't remember the building, but the one that's the big diamond with...
Any of the large, like, sweeping Gotham shots, like, this is in The Dark Knight Rises, but when the bridges explode and you see the whole city and you're like, that's not a city. So they've always done a very good job of being like, you're supposed to feel like you know this city, even though it's not a one that actually exists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shannon?
I feel like I'm liking everything that's being said here. I think I'm still thinking about The Fugitive. I think that's probably what I'm getting hung up on, because I guess if I'm going to look at the two movies separately, The Fugitive feels like it's lived in. It's definitely kind of worn. It's dark, but I mean, all of the colors, it's not exclusively black, white, dark blues. There's, you know, really muted reds and golds, and like, I mean, you've got the 90s wallpaper and the furniture and stuff like that, so it feels lived in. It feels definitely dirty. And then you look at The Dark Knight, and I mean, all Nolan films, I think for the most part, have this, you know, look of being extremely clean, lots of glass, lots of white, or if it's dark colors, it's, you know, this beautiful graphite looking black that's very matte. Everything seems perfect for the scene, but it doesn't look
to it or something.
It doesn't look touched necessarily. And then, you know, flip side, we get to some of the grimier scenes with the Joker, with, you know, cells, with banks that people go into. But I mean, Fugitive versus The Dark Knight, one seems like I could see myself living there, definitely. And then if I were alive in the 90s for a significant amount of time, or, you know, you've got The Dark Knight with Gotham. And Gotham definitely takes on this identity of its own, even though it's Chicago. So I think there's definitely a great work in both. I still kind of like The Fugitive, though. I mean, just looking
like,
at...
You're allowed to like The Fugitive.
No, go for it.
Yeah, I mean,
You are not allowed to like movies on this podcast about movies, Shannon.
This podcast isn't about liking movies.
I mentioned in the beginning. Co-hostship revoked.
Exactly.
Yeah. Nitpicking the hell out of them. 5 weeks, and then we're going to just rave and choose a winner.
Yeah.
That's usually how it goes.
Yeah, exactly.
I do have a hot take coming up in a couple of weeks.
Oh, no. I think I know what it is.
So let's start getting on with these movies.
Let's get the hot take.
What's next on our list?
We're not to the hot take yet.
No, which movie has the hot take?
No, we'll get there.
Which
we'll
is clue,
no,
a hint.
I want it right now.
We'll get there.
I want it
the
right
first
now.
Letter let's of the
go
title.
From one, let's go from one Nolan to another. Shifting gears.
Okay, I was wrong.
The Prestige. This is not the one with the hot take.
I thought this was going to be the one with the
hot
take.
No, the hot take.
Tesla coils. Tesla coils and Victorian.
I'll do the hot take next.
Is this...
Tesla coil.
I am so bad with my English eras. Is this Victorian? Is this?
I think it is technically Victorian.
Victorian era.
Where's Joy Clawson when you need her?
It's not quite Edwardian yet.
This is very... Yes, this is extremely Victorian, and it's got that kind of... I love the... I love, actually adore the look of everything in this movie. Okay. It's so gorgeous. This might be Nolan's most impressive production design. And with any like period piece, you definitely get a lot of attention to detail.
Because you do,
this one, especially.
People will rake you over the coals if something is made 2 years later than
if you have anachronisms. Unless you're Quentin Tarantino, then you can do whatever you want.
It's my own universe.
Fine.
God.
We'll get to that, guy.
But yeah, we'll get to that. But I love because like you get a lot of London, but not as much as you would normally get in a movie like that.
Yeah.
What it really is definitely. Is the interior of all the theaters where they're performing and all of the places they perform. And
all those backstages.
All the backstages, all the magic gear.
Each backstage is different.
Too. Yeah.
Yeah.
It would be very easy to, you know, kind of keep them all looking the same. But they're, you know, you could cut back and forth between two different backstages and clearly know which one you're in.
I mean, the props in this movie's all props because it's magic. And so
magic is all props.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's all props. So, I mean, it's got all the, except for the real magic. But
the making got, movies.
There you
the
go.
The movie magic.
The movie magic. But no, just the look of everything. And then the design, like the costumes, because I mean, they have to be over the top. It's great. I love the facial hair.
Oh, yeah.
Like everyone's just extremely absurd facial hair. And
it fools you for just a second.
I was going to say, and just the back and forth in when they each are trying to like go to the other one's show and they're like, I always love when the assistant's like, well, we got to make your makeup more convincing than that. And it cuts to Hugh Jackman sitting in the audience and he's got big old mutton chops that turn into a mustache.
It's great.
Yeah, it's great. And then spoiler alert at the end when you learn that Christian Bale the whole time has had his twin brother dressed up.
In prosthetics.
In prosthetics.
This one's got prosthetic hands, too?
That makeup, too, is extremely impressive the whole movie. Because you're like...
Because he gets his, his pinky and ring finger shot off? Yeah.
Yeah.
Caught feelings. We had to catch a bullet.
And then...
No.
Yes. I also... you don't get a lot of Colorado Springs, but...
I was going to say, I love all the seven Colorado Springs.
Everything in Colorado Springs.
Tesla's lab is great. Oh, I mean, which that goes without saying. But, even the hotel and the train station and stuff like that, they all have a look that is distinctly
different. And just the field of lights
is my favorite. Like, that's one of my favorite shots in the whole movie is when he walks out and the lights come on and he just looks. It's like, what?
It's like, what's the conductor?
The whole town is electric.
I love everything in that. Just the way everything looks in that movie.
Probably one of my favorite shots is... when Christian Bale is first doing his the ball trick where he jumps into the one in the cabinet and then he comes out of the other cabinet, just like that shot of just him standing in front of it and you just see him bounce the ball and then just jump backwards and it just smash cuts to something else. But just that scene with just how it's framed with the costume he's got, the ball itself, the two giant cabinets and the stage. I'm just kind of every time I'm just kind of I just want to rewind it those 10 seconds, just watch it over and over again.
Find out how we did it.
When anytime they cut to the prison and it's like, this
the
is
prison too.
The prison is totally, it's great. Cause it goes with it's the absence of color. Everyone's in gray. Everything's gross and dirty. And it's the only thing that has any color is the ball. And that's his only source to the outside world is the ball. And so of course it would be, the vibrant thing that he has. And just everything in the prison is so gross and grimy, and it's all period accurate, which is great.
But decently well lit.
Oh yeah. It's all well lit. It's got that great what's the word? It's like a cold sunlight kind of thing.
Yes.
Or it's not because it's a lot of it's in broad daylight.
I know what you're talking about, but I don't know the word for
it. It's it's in broad daylight, but it's not a warm light. Yeah. It's everyone's
wintry,
cold, a very cold light.
Very bleak light.
Yeah.
The temperature, of the shot.
Yeah. So, this movie also is pretty dark. I think that's just Nolan's style is to have a nice little dark filter over everything.
Yeah. Making a cartoon.
I mean, it starts with, the shot of the hats.
The hats.
The hats. The I definitely agree with you that this and probably Dunkirk are probably his two most like ambitious, mature as when it comes to like the design of everything. Mm-hmm. Just because mm-hmm. there's so much in both of them, but like yeah. this one's so much. I'm not sure if it's fair to say that this one's more detailed, but that's not important.
They're just different.
Yeah, they're just very different. But yeah, like I agree with you on that. And then I didn't really notice it until you said it, but like they are in London. But they don't like dwell on that fact. Mm-hmm. And I'm so thankful for that because like
there's no like big bin shot yeah, or like yeah. anything like
right,
that.
There's like right. no, none of the bridges. No one's ever like, oh, good old jolly London town. It's like you bring London to shame or Christian yeah. Bale, Hugh Jackman. And like it could be so easy to just have all those random shots of like the streets of London and everything. But they don't because it's all about the interiors. Yeah. And I didn't really notice that until now. I'm just kind of like, wow, like. I really appreciate that.
I was reading this snippet online about, I guess it was an interview that Christopher Nolan had given about the feel of London and it being curated to his liking. It was basically him, I guess, talking about he wanted the feel of the Victorian era, but didn't want it to feel extremely like London. And he did that by handpicking or by emphasizing the fact that it was an era where there was a barrage of information, lots of text everywhere. This is the beginning of this information overload kind of age to an extent. So a lot of the walls are perfectly curated to have all kinds of posters, a lot of lettering. I mean, it's not image heavy just yet. And I think that's really interesting that it's London according to him, according to the time period. And it definitely gives off that feel that I think he does very well. He takes the skill and applies it to The Dark Knight. It's very stylized according to him. It's Chicago. In a way, according to him, according to the comics, of course, but he's very good at that. Nolan is, he's good at a lot of things.
Yeah.
And that's why we like him. That's why he's got two movies on this season.
Yeah. I don't really have anything negative to say about The Prestige.
More David Bowie.
More, everything could use more David Bowie. Rest in peace.
More Tesla coils.
I'm always fine with that. We need a Tesla coil in the studio here.
At least he wasn't a teapot in this one.
No. When Carter reminded me that a year ago Twin Peaks ended.
Yes, as of tonight.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
It is. It's very much true.
Yeah.
It's beside the point. All right. Do anyone else have anything else to say on Prestige? All
right. Let's move right.
Should we get on to the hot take?
Yes.
Is this the hot take?
This is the hot take.
Bring us what the movie hot take.
All right. Before Sunrise.
Okay.
Here's where I'm at. This movie is pretty. But there's not really any production design.
It's Vienna.
I'm 100% going to agree. Yeah.
They're just walking around the city. So it's a pretty movie because the city is pretty.
But there's nothing intentional, right?
What's the intentional design? The only intentional design is that, like, it turns to night and then, like... But it's just the progression of the day because that's what the movie's about.
Yeah.
But there's not really any, like, serious effort because they're in Vienna.
Yeah. And also, a lot of it, like... The record store looks fine, but
like a typical record store.
All of the locations are made special because the main romance is in, not even the main romance, the entire story, which is just about the two of them, is in that location.
Yeah, that's what the movie is. The movie is their relationship.
Yeah.
So that's
it's not about the pretty backgrounds. It's not, I don't feel like this is that it's hot not of a that take. Difficult.
Yeah, I mean, because
like
can't even make that hot of a take.
Like it's.
I love
it's
the. Like, I actually
take it. Best.
I watched it today for the first time. I really enjoyed the movie, and I'm anxious to watch the other two because I haven't seen them.
Oh,
we'll
boy.
Get to those later
definitely
this week.
Definitely, for
but,
sure.
But those. But yeah, this movie, I'm like, where is the production design? I mean, it's there because that's a movie, and every movie has production design.
Yeah, the choice of where they sit in the train. I mean,
but it's just like overall. It's very much like
find
oh, we're going
spots
we're
Vienna.
Going to a pretty city.
Right.
Yeah,
we don't have to worry about the backdrop as much because the city
because
itself
Vienna's
is
gorgeous,
already
right.
pretty.
Yeah.
There's not as many choices you're making in that movie. I mean, whereas you're looking at something like The Fugitive with mm-hmm. Chicago, The Dark Knight with Chicago. I mean, we don't really get to see a whole lot of choices by Richard Linklater in that way because, you know, he has the story. He has all of the verbal and all the talk and the screenplay, whatever we call those these days.
Because I was thinking about Before Sunrise when we were talking about The Fugitive too. It's like The Fugitive, like it's like, oh, we're in Chicago and Chicago, but like they have all the costumes and everything. There are like the various sets and all the different places they go to that you can tell were planned out and like made and designed. Whereas, like we've said, like in Before Sunrise, it's like, oh, we're in the record store and it's a record store. And it's like, we're in Vienna and it's just kind of Vienna. And it's like Ethan Hawke and I forget the actress's name.
Julie Delpy.
Yeah, it's just kind of like they're wearing their clothes.
Yep.
And there it is.
And I mean, I feel like there's a lot of intention in the script to not have to worry about it. Like, you know, he doesn't have any money. So, you know, all he has is the clothes on his back and his bag. Like,
and they're also tourists. I mean, I'm thinking of like where tourism incorporated in any of the other films. So it would only make sense that they're visiting.
Yeah, I know. It's just
Vienna's biggest spots.
Just in the context of the podcast here when comparing it to the other movies. And it's
For sure.
It's like we like to talk about. It's like, yeah, this works in a vacuum, and like, yes, it works for the story, but so does all the rest of the production design we've been talking about.
And so here's where I turn Carter's hot take into something that I think is like where I think it does not work for this movie, which is that yes, they have Vienna and they've got, you know, a lot of big shots of the city and stuff, but a lot of these locations were very close in on the two of them because it's a romance film. So like, it could be any, like that cafe could be here in Austin, Texas, you know, for all we know. Like there's times where like, not, I'm not saying it is, but like there's times where it's like, you're in this big, beautiful city. Let's see more of it. Like, you know, whereas, you know, we're watching them lie down on some grass at one point. And you're like, yeah, grass. They would do that, well, but that's grass. Like,
find that anywhere.
So that's where I think that, you know, they had an opportunity with, to do some more in the production design, and maybe because of the vision for how it would look, maybe they missed some opportunities with doing a little bit more in location scouting and production design.
Yeah, it's kind of like Moonlight in that way from the first season, where it's like it doesn't need to be like super elaborate for the movie, but
when you're comparing it to the richness of other places, when you're comparing it to movies,
the London of the Prestige or Gotham in the Dark Knight
and Pride Rock and the Pride Lands,
but sorry, your hot take wasn't that hot.
I will say, like I said, the movie is very pretty.
Yes,
it's a very beautiful movie.
Yes. If we were talking cinematography,
it would be
this would be a very different
separate
episode.
Conversation, of course. But I mean,
yeah. That's
but alas, we are not.
Does
not
anyone else have anything to say?
No.
Or should we keep chugging along?
I like this
movie. Keep it moving.
I like this movie, too. All right. I'm going to get to... Is this a hotter take? All right. We're going to talk about Pulp Fiction.
Okay.
I will say it's not my favorite production design out of all the movies we have, but I do think it might actually be the best, and I'll tell you why.
Okay. That was a very interesting juxtaposition of words there. It's not my favorite, but it is good.
Well, I'm saying, like, if you're looking...
Based on how you've been talking, that is a much hotter take.
Okay.
Like, yes.
You right. gotta learn your take temperature.
Here's what
you need to learn how to take temperature.
Take thermometer might be in order here. We can sell take thermometers?
Here's what I'll say about Pulp Fiction.
Teespring.com.
This is not the get-rich-quick schemes.
Not necessarily my favorite, but Quentin Tarantino is such a control freak that he made every single shot in that movie. He designed it from the ground up. So he knew exactly how he wanted everything in that movie to look. Every color, every shot, every set, everything in that movie was meticulously placed how it is.
This is one of the ones I thought were meticulously come up a lot.
And it's one of the, he's such a like a batshit crazy control freak. And it's like, it comes through. It has an aesthetic that, like, with all of his movies, is really uniquely him. That's why it's so cliche. And it's like, it's not my favorite of, you know, of the production designs and the looks of all these movies. But I have to say, it's probably the best. I don't know that any other movie has this close of an attention to detail to every single aspect of the look of the movie like this one does.
Yeah. There's some standouts to me in what you're talking about. I think, first of all, designing a big Kahuna Burger logo and stuff when you could have, you know, gone out and been like, hey, Touchstone, get me in touch with McDonald's. We just want to have a burger, you know? Or, you know, designing Jackrabbit Slims to be, which I think is probably the best example of, like,
production.
Yeah. Because in a studio. That's obviously in a studio or a space they've rented and totally built that restaurant out to exact specifications. But Okay, so here's where I, like, once again, I have to give props because it has that color palette that is very pulpy. The colors are very vivid, but I don't necessarily like the look. So I'm like, I have to give props for being well done in the sense that, like, it is a consistent look throughout the whole thing. I don't love that look, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's too much red for my liking, but it definitely, there's an attention to red almost everywhere in the movie. Even the script, I think, to a certain extent. I mean, you've got, okay, script-wise, I guess I wrote down, quote, maybe we should have sat in the maroon section, something like that. So there's always this kind of pull to warmer colors while we're in the diner, outside of the diner. We've got, I mean, down to the red nail polish on Mia's fingernails when John Travolta and Uma Thurman are both only wearing black and white. I mean, Vincent's car is red. I mean, there's red literally everywhere. And, I mean, it gets
not
down
to
this.
The blood.
The blood. The seediness of this entire film. You know. And the blood is pervading through everything to a certain extent.
There's a lot of red and even, like, the yellows. And like, the yellows have a lot of red in them, like, surprisingly. So,
yeah.
I, like, you say it's like, oh, this is the best because it is so meticulous and because there is so much attention to detail. We just talked about all the attention to detail and all the meticulousness and the prestige. And so I mean, it's like, I don't exactly see what sets Pulp Fiction above the prestige when the prestige actually had, like, all these more original locations and all these more actual, like, sets and props that they built. Whereas, like, Pulp Fiction, the, like, most, like, actual production design I can think of is like creating Jack Rabbit Slims, the big Kahuna Burger logo, Zed's whole shop and all that. Mm-hmm. And just like, oh, I cringe just thinking about that whole sequence.
But and, yeah, the rest of it, like, I get what you're saying.
But then the rest of it
is there's a seedy motel room, there's a bar.
A lot of it just seems like, oh, this is just a seedy city. This is just a pulpy city.
Yeah.
But what I do really like is everyone's very specific costumes and how everybody has their specific look. I love, is it Vincent?
Yeah, Vincent.
Vincent Vega and
Jules.
I cannot remember anybody's name in this movie. I haven't seen it in a while. But I love them just walking around in the suits. And just, I've seen this movie. I remember it enough to talk about it. I'm not going to ask you the basic plot points and just be like, So Vincent lives at the end of this movie, right?
Correct.
Like,
I don't know, the timeline's so jumbled. He might have come back to life.
It's like, so Jules stays a hitman for the rest of his life, right? No, I'm not going to, like, I know what happens in this movie. I remember this movie.
Yeah, I get what you're saying, but the costumes are used to great effect, too.
Yeah, like, that's what I'm saying. It's like, I don't, like,
it helps you keep track of that jumbled story, though.
It's like, and I'm sure Christopher Nolan also set up his shots the way that he wanted them to be set up. And so being like, oh, this production design is so good because this is how Tarantino wanted it. It's like every shot in these other movies is how these directors wanted it. But like, I love how the costumes fits everybody's personality. They kind of like have their own, I'm not sure if motif is the right word, but the suits on the hitmen and then how they, when they get all the blood on them, they're just wearing like the t-shirts and like the shorts. And it's like, huh, that's funny. I like that. Shows where you're at. And then when Vincent dies, he's back in the suit and it's kind of like, okay. And it's like the consistency of it all. And what's Bruce Willis's character's name?
Butch.
Butch. And how he's just like, I love the costumes and how they're used on everybody in this movie. And I do very much like the design of Jack Rabbit Slim's and of Zed's basement as much as I hate that whole sequence, the fucking, pardon my French, but like the whole gimp and all that. And it's just kind of like, what? I just like, I'm impressed.
The reason why there's public domain music being used in that. Very few bands wanted their music used during that scene.
I'm just like, I'm impressed by this, but I don't like it kind of thing. And so it's like, I don't agree that it's the best because I guess I don't quite understand that thought process there, but it's still good. I think I kind of agree with Shannon. There's a little much red, but it's not so bad as in what's that movie with Ezra Miller and Hilary Swank, Tilda Swinton? We need to talk about Kevin.
We need to talk about
where
Kevin.
There's just red everywhere, and it's like, hey, you see the red in this shot? You see the red in this shot? And it's like, I see the red. Calm down. Whereas with Pulp Fiction, it's like, yeah, it's red, but it's here for a reason.
That was so sudden.
I'm sorry. I don't like we need to talk about Kevin.
Did you see the red on our recording too?
Here's what I'll... Let me try and clarify. So something with the prestige. I would say a lot of like detail and like attention to detail definitely went into the crafting of every set. But once the cameras were rolling, I mean, they had an idea of how they wanted their shot to look and they filmed it and everything was you know, as it should be per the director's, you know, wanting. But in like, take any single shot from Pulp Fiction, and I can tell you that every single thing in the composition of every single shot, I would imagine that Quentin Tarantino was like, this is exactly what I want it to be, this exact way.
Then you could make that. You're saying I imagine, or like I would assume this. It's like you could say that same thing about these other movies. You could say I would imagine. I can imagine Christopher Nolan was there saying, this is how I want this to go. This is exactly how this needs to be. I mean, like, I know how Tarantino is as a director, so, like, that's probably true. But saying, like, oh, I imagine this is how that is, like, you could say that for any other movie. And when we get to Back to the Future, you could say, like, I imagine Robert Zemeckis wanted it done exactly like this.
Yeah. What it seems like is that neither The Prestige or Pulp Fiction are going to be voted off this week. I think it's just a disagreement.
Well, I mean, and I think what might be, when you look at Pulp Fiction is structured obviously entirely off of pop culture because that is how somebody like Quentin Tarantino knows how to communicate. So, and pop culture is very accessible to us. Pop culture is not very accessible to Victorian London, whereabouts time period is you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, when you're looking at what Lance's drug house or whatever, and, you know, we're looking at them about to stab Mia or they're dragging her body, you know, into the house and we see the life and the operation game boards on one of the side tables, something like that. I mean, I would like to think, and I guess I can't exactly prove that, but because it's so accessible to all of us, pop culture is so readily available to us as a way of communicate, which might not be happening in The Prestige, it might seem, I think, more methodically planned out because who just happens to have, you know,
life and
operation right there as we're about to stab like a 8-freaking-inch needle in somebody's heart with little blood drop right on her heart breastplate.
Mm-hmm. Gotta stab. You want me to stab her three times?
No, it's just one time.
Just one time. But yes,
you have
think
a magic marker.
What are you looking for? I'm looking for the adrenaline. I'm not going to find it there and all that mess. Come on, like it's just like no.
So yeah, I mean, I think both Nolan and Tarantino definitely had a lot of hand in the composition of all the shots.
Every shot,
because they're both considered modern auteurs. I don't know if one's you know batshit craziness makes it better than the other, but I think what we can see here is that we're singing praise to both films in this department. Let's move on because we've been talking about these for a while.
Sorry, just real quick. I just want to say, Carter, I'm very glad you did not say that Tarantino seduces us with the camera because that is the one phrase that I think to be the most pretentious, most bullshit thing I hate when people talk about Tarantino.
No.
They're like, oh, he sets everything up so meticulously. He seduces you with the camera. And it's like, shut the hell up,
definitely
Donnie.
Definitely not a seduction. Yeah, there are some filmmakers where I could say that, but Tarantino's not
but
one of them.
I hate when people say that. I'm like, stop. So I just want to say I'm very glad you didn't say it. Because that's where I thought you were going for a second. I was like, Carter, I'm going to come over there and unplug your microphone if you say what I think you're going to say.
No.
But you didn't, so I won't.
You know who does seduce you with the camera? Robert Zemeckis. Back to
I
the Future.
I was thinking the same thing.
I was thinking of directors whose, you know, just use of the camera just draws me into bed. Robert Zemeckis.
Old Bobby Zims.
You know, that weird CGI Beowulf movie.
Old Bobby Zims.
That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about Back to the Future.
I saw that movie.
Which I think
it was weird.
Not good.
It's a weird
Maybe
movie.
Maybe the most attention to detail.
I would say set design wise.
Set design.
Just because they have to do the... It's also to be the most gimmicky.
This is like the third time we've talked about who's had the most attention to detail.
Here's what I'll say.
It's like...
I don't know that this one has the most attention to detail, but this one is definitely the most like gimmicky of their like, look, we're in the 50s.
And it's like, oh, yes.
Like, and now we're in the 80s.
It's like, oh, I like how you've dressed up the Warner Brothers lot to look like the 50s and the 80s.
Real city. It is a real city that they, I've watched the behind the scenes stuff. They had to shoot all the 1950s stuff second because they didn't want to dirty up this. They cleaned up a city to shoot the 1950s stuff and then left and were like, this is your.
Well, then it looks suspiciously a lot like the Warner Brothers lot.
There's some stuff that I'm sure there are some scenes that are on the Warner lot, but that town square town square.
No, the real. Yeah, I know the town square is real because on the Warner Brothers tour, people are like, oh, is this Back to the Future? And they go, no, that was not here.
No,
because
that town square is Gilmore Girls.
Yes.
And a lot Grease of Live.
Yeah.
And also Pretty Little Liars and a lot of other things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, well then, well, I'm wrong. Then it just looks a lot like the Warner Brothers.
That's what I'm saying.
Sets.
It looks very artificial.
But
the Warner Brothers lot was designed after whatever, wherever this place's town square is, I mean.
For sure. But there's some great attention to detail in the changing of shops. It's a little gimmicky. It makes some jokes and stuff. Like, the movie theater is a church at one point. It's also a movie theater and then a porn theater. Another point. Like,
That's why.
There's, you know, stuff like changing Twin Pines to Lone Pine to, you know, even the clock tower itself looks cool. The, you know, courthouse with the clock on it.
Like, it is gimmicky, but it's, like, it works. And
it definitely works.
But, yeah, okay, I totally see what you guys are saying about, like, this is it is a very good attention to detail. It's just a very different kind of attention to detail.
And they're going for a different look. It's not authenticity.
I totally get you now.
And the Texaco, showing you the Texaco in 1985 and 1955. And, I mean, it's a thing that we're not going to, you know, I'm not giving it points for the next two movies in the series. But it's stuff that they keep attention to detail from the first movie move it on to.
It's always good to have continuity.
Continuity
is so great.
Yeah, but I would say the second one is the most offensive in terms of like the future.
Yes, well, they didn't.
We're not talking about then.
Because this one's in the past. Back to the Future Part 2. But, so there's a lot of cool stuff. Seeing the design of the Lion's Estate, you know, that
they get there, it's just a field.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this crazy idea about breeding pine trees.
But I mean, there's a lot of really cool, you know, the outfits for the 50s are, you know, while they look very, you know, this is a movie's idea of what the 50s look like, like the fabrics and the brand logos and stuff like that are all authentic to the time, even though, you know, not everyone's always wearing poodle skirts.
Yeah,
like
that's Doc Brown's mansion.
Mm-hmm.
The design of the souped-up time-traveling DeLorean.
Yeah.
Because it could have just very easily been like, oh, yeah, we got a DeLorean, and we just threw some weird-looking thing on it. But it's like, no, they made
the inside of that car.
The flux capacitor and all that other junk they have in there, that's really good.
We talked about the opening sequence on the bonus episode. But all of those clocks and then the news broadcasts and the cans of dog food and they're falling on the floor.
The giant amplifier.
Even the tiny guitar that Marty McFly plays to, you know, use the giant amplifier. There's some good stuff.
Yeah. Shannon, this was your first time watching the movie.
It was fantastic. Oh, I loved it.
It's so good.
That's what I like to hear.
But I love the design of the movie. It's similar to a lot of other, you know, similar to a lot of those other adventure 80s classics or whatever. It really does just open itself up for, you know, that for you to imagine the world that's going on in there. So we can maybe talk about that a little bit next week if this guy sticks around. But I think Hill Valley is a place I would like to be in, and not just in the 50s, but also in the 80s and later on in 2015. So.
Because it's a real place.
I wish I would be living there right now if it was a real place. I have an unhealthy obsession with this movie.
But sounds pretty healthy to me.
It's a good movie.
It's good.
It's good on so many levels. And production design is also one of them. I mean, it's very, everything's intentional for the most part. And I definitely, I guess what I was really drawn to was the design of each McFly sibling a little bit. I guess I was fixating a lot on the colors of his sister's clothing. You know, she's a very opinionated, will talk, you know, stands up for herself loud, wears clothing that matches. Marty's very much wanting to play the cool with it, individual. He's got, you know, his classic Nikes on. He's always wearing red on top, whether it's in the 50s or in the 80s, which also, I guess, Biff wears, like 1950s Biff, if I'm remembering correctly, he wears a bright red collared shirt at one point in the movie. Yes. And I kind of link those two colors to the, I mean, both characters have a bit of an innate willingness to fight on any occasion, yeah. Short, and willingness to stand up for themselves.
Short-tempered.
Thank you. That's what I was looking for.
And you'll get to Back to the Future 2 eventually, where you'll find out Marty does not like to be called chicken.
Yes, that I can remember. I thought at one point it was going to pop up in this movie, but it I guess that's not something that gets explored until later.
It's a weird characterization that just randomly pops up, and they play a little chord there as if you're like, oh, I'm supposed to know he doesn't like being called chicken. We're not talking about Back to the Future Part 2.
Not
yet.
Maybe someday. should we move on? I think we all... Is there anything people don't like about this movie in terms of production design?
I do not like Pepsi.
That's so fair. If I could change one thing, it'd be more Coke.
No, I mean, that was partially a joke, but... I mean, there is a whole lot of... I guess what I found a little difficult... just because I wasn't sure, is that there is so much branding in this film that I'm like, what was intentional as an aesthetic and what was actually just because, I mean, like, you know, what is it, like Budweiser? I think I at one point wrote down all of...
Yeah, which ones of them are intentional branding to show you the
age? JCPenney's, Diet Pepsi, Kellogg's.
Or which ones were universal brand partners?
Right, right. So
like
I think...
Tab, Pepsi, Free.
That got like, me a little...
Those were intentionally like, let's remind you, he's not in the 80s. But
y'all, Tab is gross.
Never
had
it.
Yeah, it was,
really?
It's not very good.
Tab is disgusting.
Tab doesn't have that velvety crispness.
They brought it back in a cross promotion with Ready Player One. It's gross.
It's like, no.
Describe the flavor.
It tastes in one word. It's like, because it's zero calories, and it's like a more diet Coke. It's like,
but it's not worse than New Coke, which I've heard described as warm cat pee.
Oh,
New Coke, yeah.
No one's ever going to get to try it anymore. I was not around for New Coke, but apparently, like, as bad as Tab is, nothing is worse than New Coke.
Yeah, no.
There are people that are still fans of Tab. No one was a fan of it.
Yeah, no. It's like Diet Coke, and someone was like, let's take more of the Coke flavor out and just add more of the weird diet aftertaste.
Delicious.
Yeah.
We just crossed Tab. And New Coke off of our list of promotional partners for Film Fracas, but that is okay.
Think if they had like a Coca-Cola LaCroix.
If we get a potential Tab sponsor, we will expunge this episode from the
Tab
record.
Is our new favorite.
We will not be
carbonated beverage.
If we ever got a sponsorship offer from New Coke specifically, not Coca-Cola as a whole, only New Coke, I'd be impressed and I would take it just out of sheer.
How much money do you think New Coke would give us?
Brett, if we were to ever get a soda sponsorship, it would 100% be Jolt Cola.
I wish.
Oh, Jolt Cola, sponsor the show.
Please.
Brett is your biggest fan.
Honestly.
Jolt Cola.
Let's move on to our next movie.
All right, our final movie.
Final movie.
Final movie.
One Jolt
Finally,
Cola
we made it.
Singing in the rain. We can't sing anymore of the song.
Yeah, this movie
we got to change the lyrics just a little bit.
Singing in the pain.
Plane.
Singing in the pain. Right.
So this one, good.
Yes, so good.
So good.
Happy,
Let's
beautiful,
talk about
bright.
Production design, and I want to start in one spot, which is the whole Broadway melody sequence, everything in that.
I got some mixed feelings about Broadway melody.
So the sequence is
excellent.
So long.
It's so long. Excellent production has... absolutely nothing to do with anything else, and it's like so out of place.
Then they
go into a dream ballet.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So you're twice removed from the movie, and it's like I love it. I love what I'm seeing, but let's get back to the movie.
Before the dream ballet, which I love the dream ballet and like the steps and the way like that.
The kind of giant flowing veil or shawl or whatever it is. Yeah.
Yes. But what I love is the cheesy set look of the, like, gotta
the dance
part of it. Where
it's yes.
The look, you know, all the different agent doors and, you know, it's just, it's ridiculous. but I love it. And I was worried we were going to get to this and people were going to be like, it looks bad or something, you know, it doesn't look realistic. No, I was like, the point is not to look anywhere near realistic.
No, this movie looks exactly like it's supposed to.
Oh, yeah.
That's one of the few things in this movie where I'm like, they nailed that 100%. It's like, would we talk about choreography? I don't even know what we would talk about choreography. I
love the choreography.
Because that's not a performance.
Gene Kelly is an amazing choreographer. And
I don't know. I'm just going to say this movie, I think, has the best dance choreography of any movie ever. Mm-hmm. I think this one actually has the best dance choreography of any movie ever made in history.
I mean, it may be the best movie musical ever made.
I'm inclined to agree. It's very good. And it's really interesting because, like, in terms of, like, Academy Awards, it was only nominated for Best Supporting Actress for the girl that played Lena Lamont and Best Score.
Mm-hmm. Lena Lamont is a gem.
Oh, yeah.
It's wonderful.
She was fantastic. But, like, it was it wasn't taken seriously at all, which shows in the movie, but it's gone down in history as, like, one of if not the best musicals, like, ever made.
Absolutely.
And if it was, like, made today, you know for sure it would be up there nominated for every single award under the sun, including, like, Best Foreign Documentary or what
have
you. Short
form foreign document.
it's so good.
No, it's fantastic. The production design is great. I love movies that are about the movies because then they don't get as they're not as uptight about like letting you know that it's, you know, a set at times. Mm-hmm. Like the diction room.
Also on a set.
Yeah.
Yeah. But like the diction room where they're talking.
Oh
like,
my God.
And then, you know, Cosmo and Don have their dance with, and like, you're like, this is way too big of an office because it's clearly a set, but like, it's on the studio lot, so it might be a set. Who knows? Like,
Chester chooses chestnuts.
The look and feel of this movie is so good.
Excellent.
Very good.
I have nothing bad to say, and also weaker.
Really? Yeah,
we're running a little long.
Yeah,
we're recording this very late at night, and we're also already over an hour long, and we still haven't.
Okay.
So does anyone have anything bad to say about this?
Anything else to say about?
No, it's beautiful, gorgeous.
The production design,
a tribute to American delectable world cinema.
Moving on.
All right. Can I have a winner without a loser? So our winners this week.
Except you can't have a loser without a winner.
Our winners this week.
Choose our winners. Let's go.
Just all
choose one for each of us.
Choose us forever. My winner this week is The Prestige.
What's Shannon's winner?
I don't know.
Tell me. What is it? Choose everybody's winners.
What?
Do it. No. Come on. Quick. No. Go.
You got it, Carter.
No. What?
Based on conversation. Go. Do it.
No.
Come on.
It can be a very
okay. Carter's is The Prestige. Yours might also be The Prestige.
Yes.
Yes.
Shannon's is ooh.
Come on.
Maybe three, also The Prestige.
Two, one. Shannon, what is it?
The Fugitive?
What is
it?
No, actually, Singing in the Rain.
Singing in the Rain. Yeah.
Mine's Back to the Future.
Oh.
Wow, right. We shouldn't. Does anyone want to give reasons why there's...
All right, losers. Carter, what's everybody's loser? Go.
No, we actually
everyone's actually...
We need to decide everyone's losers.
No,
our reasons why they're winners.
Winner,
go back and listen to the rest of this podcast. Yeah. Why just skip all the way to the end?
The Prestige is beautiful. Okay, my loser this week.
Okay.
My loser this week is Before Sunrise. Made it pretty clear. Not really there. It's just a pretty city, which is itself kind of production design, but not really because they didn't design the city.
It's a little more location scouting.
Yeah, location scouting.
They just showed up and showed up.
So, yes. Goodbye, Before Sunrise. I hardly knew ye.
Same. I don't have anything else to add. It's, you know, this is a Mary Poppins situation. It just doesn't quite have the element we're looking for when talking about these other films.
Yeah, my loser is going to be Before Sunrise because with every other movie we talked about, there was something to talk about. Before Sunrise, there was just not really anything. If it was cinematography, there would have been something, but just...
Totally different conversation.
But, that's how the cookie crumbles.
One of Richard Linklater's masterpieces is definitely... I mean, it's a masterpiece for many reasons, but, you know, if all we can come up with is a nice little 5-minute, you know, it's known for other things. It's a great movie, but I mean, I'm not thinking about it for production design. Exactly.
Yeah.
So, bye.
Goodbye. Before Sunrise.
Before Sunrise.
Farewell. Carter so hardly knew you.
Taking that train.
Literally hardly knew you. Saw it this morning. I guess I didn't need to.
But watch all three of them.
Yeah, I'll watch the other
ones. Watch all three of them.
We'll get to those, like I said, later this week.
So, it only gets better.
What are the consequences for the movies this season?
Getting kicked off the train to Vienna.
No, they get on a train, and then that train goes... Where? What happens? What happens to the train?
No, the train goes through a door, and then the train's twin brother comes out the other door. Without the movie.
He goes down a trap door and drowns.
No, I like the cabinets and the doors.
the train's twin brother.
What happened to that first train?
Gets sent to prison
we'll
and hanged.
Never know.
Yes.
Okay, I like it. Cool. So that's a... That's the first fracas.
Right. Yes. You can find me on Twitter at CA Spilliards, like spill something in your yard and add an S. I tweet there occasionally.
You've been retweeting a lot lately.
I have been as of today. There have been some good stuff on there. Anywho, my recommendation this week is the 1988 film Tucker, The Man in His Dream, a Francis Ford Coppola film, Lucasfilm production, actually.
Yes, you were telling me about this earlier this week.
I adore it. It's about the real-life story of Preston Tucker. If you don't know, it's absolutely fascinating. He was a maverick car designer. He paved the way for some really innovative car features, like seat belts. And windshield wipers.
I thought you were just going to say, like seat belts.
Those things cost more lives than they save. I do not believe that film Francis advocates wearing your seatbelt.
But it's he was, Ford and all the big motor companies were like, no, we have to destroy him. These ideas are too innovative. And it's a really interesting story and a really interesting movie and a fantastic performance by Jeff Bridges.
Right?
Yes. Francis Ford Coppola, love the movie. Go watch it. Tucker, The Man in His Dreams.
So this is different from Seabiscuit, where Jeff Bridges is also a man who makes cars?
Yes.
Interesting.
It's better.
Interesting.
I like Tucker and Seabiscuit. It actually just got its 30th anniversary.
I feel like those are two very different movies. But okay. Anyway.
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Robbie_DShazer. I post things all the time there, so go check it out. My recommendation this week is not going to be a movie or a TV show, but another podcast. I am recommending the audio drama Batman at Bat. A group of comedians from Chicago have put together an audio drama depicting the baseball game between the Arkham Assassins and Batman's Big Shots. It's so much fun to listen to. If you're a fan of Batman, if you're a fan of the comics, especially if you like some good gentleman ghost jokes, they're all in there. So
what defines a gentleman ghost?
Gentleman ghost
joke?
Is a Batman villain who is a ghost and at one point was a gentleman.
Yep,
I love it.
He made a bad deal with the devil, or a bad deal with a devil, and
yes.
Now he's a ghost.
He's impossible to pitch to because no one can see him. It's just such a funny concept. I love it. There's going to be 9 episodes of it. I think the first 4 will be out by the time this drops. So go check it out. It's worth a listen. Episodes are only about 15 minutes. You can listen like 2 of them in your commute. So
you can find me on Snapchat and Twitter at @BrettJHNSN1. Post movie reviews every now and then. If there's a movie you want me to review and then argue about with me, let me know. I'll do what I can. My recommendation this week is going to be Robbie told me about this podcast before we started recording, and it got me thinking of this animated show that came out like early 2010s, I think, called Batman the Brave and the Bold, which is so good. It's so funny. It's a big love letter to Silver Age comics. It's about Batman teaming up with all the various heroes you've never heard of, heroes you have heard of, going to take on every Batman villain that's ever been. It's so good. There's a whole lot of gentleman ghost in Batman the Brave and the Bold.
Really?
Yeah, there's a whole lot of him. You get his backstory and everything, and it's so good. It's so much fun. There is a scene where Batman is about to beat up a female villain who's piloting this giant mech, and she's like, "You wouldn't hit a lady, would you?" And he says, and I quote, "The hammers of justice," and he holds up his fists, "are unisex." And then he... And if that doesn't convince you to go watch this show, I don't know what will. It's so good.
Wow.
You can now find me on Twitter at Hammers of Justice. I will be changing.
Don't you dare. Don't you disrespect Batman like that.
Hey, guys. You can follow me on Letterboxd at Zed's Dead 5. And if you...
Zed's Dead, baby.
That's right. Dead. Zed's dead. Really putting the Zed's dead and Zed's dead five. And I'm going to...
Zed's dead five, the reckoning.
Yes, the first Zed's four five, the reckoning. Zed's that dead is correct, five. Actually.
Zed takes Manhattan. No, that'd be eight.
I'd like Zed to take Chicago, actually. I think that would be pretty interesting. I'm recommending this week Divorce Italian Style, which is dark and supposed to be really funny. And, I mean, it works in all of the most kind of bizarre ways. And it features a young-ish, I think his name is Marcello Mastroianni. Very funny, black and white, definitely dark, but... worth a watch. It's only an hour and 5 minutes. No, it's 105 minutes, but it's okay. So if you've got some time.
It's a little bit longer.
If you've got some time, watch your hour and 505-minute movie. It's lots of fun.
And 1 hour and 500 minutes long.
Oh, my God.
Well, this has been a great meticulous episode of Film Fracas.
There's another meticulous about this.
There was no seduction of the camera involved.
God, Shannon, I will kick you out of here so fast.
Wow.
Would you say we seduced the microphone in this podcast?
We used anchor.fm to seduce the audience into supporting us at the end of every episode.
That's the opposite of seduction.
Let's go with
shameless plugs.
What's the opposite of seduction? Like scaring or spooking? Or
assault.
Revolt.
Revolt?
Revolt?
That's not the right word, but I think that's
That's the right feeling. That's the right vibe.
Anyway, tune in again next week where we're going to talk about our other 7 movies.
Yes.
Hey-o. And we'll start whittling it all the way down to Best Picture. Thanks for listening. See you guys next week.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Film Fracas. We know there are a lot of shows on the web, and we're so glad you took the time to listen to ours. Thank you to Carter Spilliards, Brett Johnson, and Shannon Widener for helping to write and produce each episode. Please consider giving us a 5-star rating wherever you listen. It really does help get the word out about the show. You can follow the show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Film Fracas. Once again, thank you for listening, and we can't wait for you to hear our next episode.
The podcast you just heard was published with Anchor. Got something you want to say to the creator of this show? Send them a voice message using the Anchor app, free for iOS and Android.